Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 2 Monday Night Football edition, with almost every game already in the books and two data points for some of your favorite teams, some have overachieved, some have underachieved. We, of course, will get to all of that. First things first, though, I am your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only, Payne Insider.
Good morning.
What's going on, buddy? Another day of football, another day of curious results, to say the least.
Sunday was an odd day, that's for sure. Couple things didn't swing our way. Well, let's just put it that way.
Seems to be a growing trend when we talk about the NFL being odd. An action-packed show on tap for you today, as always, as we'll look back at some of the games that we watched over the weekend. Dr. David Chow will be here later in the show as well to give us some context on a few marquee injuries to some of the notable faces at the quarterback position. Of course, a Monday Night Football preview between the Browns and Jets, some look-ahead lines, and a little bit of housekeeping on top of all of that. But Payne, when we look at some of the games that unfolded yesterday, I know we usually do the good, bad, and the ugly. Maybe we'll focus on a little more of the positive, but of course there's some negative that comes along with it. What really stood out from what you saw over the weekend?
I liked what I saw from San Francisco, obviously. That was the big blowout of the day, other than the abortion that transpired in Miami. But, you know, I liked the entire makeup of the 49ers and the plan that they had going into the week. You know, they survived the Tampa opener. It didn't look good. The defense made enough plays, but then Kyle Shanahan elects not to go back home. So the 49ers stayed in Youngstown preparing for the Bengals all week. So I thought that was a smart plan to begin with. And then the offense finally had an explosion. And you look at the first three quarters before Shanahan actually takes his foot off the gas in this blowout. And the Niners put up like a fraction less than 10 yards per play, nearly a 70% success rate through the first three quarters, 12 explosive plays. So that's the Shanahan offense I think we know. Then the other side of the ball, you got defensive coordinator Robert Saleh. It appears that unit's made some major strides on that side of the ball as well.
Do you think this is more of what we're going to see going forward with the 49ers, or do you think you chalk it up to, hey, look, this is a Bengals defense, that's why they perform so well? I'm not going to diminish winning your first two games of the season, especially when you're in the Eastern time zone and you're away from home for as long as they were, but hey, this 49ers team finally going to look like the contender that we thought they could have been last season with a healthy Jimmy Garoppolo?
Same Bengals defense that only allowed about less than 250 yards on the road in Seattle. So certainly a disappointing performance from the Bengals defensively. It was a unit that we didn't think was going to be very good. So it was a little surprising opener in Seattle. But it looks like at this point, San Francisco is that team that pros were betting over their win total this season. They obviously get Big Ben at home in week three. It looks like, you know, he's probably not going to play for that game. So it sets up nicely for San Francisco. Let's see if they can get out to 3-0.
Since the current playoff format began back in 1990, teams that start the season 2-0 make the playoffs more than 61% of the time. So, Payne, if we talk about the 49ers, I think we have to tip our hat to another team that's won opening its first two games on the road, albeit in the same stadium and roughly in the same state, the Buffalo Bills.
That's awesome, right? I think from the outside, you get the schedule and you're like, ah, shit. Like, opening the season with back-to-back road games, we heard all week about the trends and teams playing back-to-back openers and how negative that was. You know, fortunately, both the games are in the same state and in the same stadium. And now you're 2-0. And you look at your schedule, 8 of the final 14 games are at home. You have better than a league average home field advantage that actually increases as the season goes on. Josh Allen looks to be a little bit improved really early. But through two games, completion percentage about 11% higher than last season. The interceptable pass rate, which is key, declined by about 1% year over year through 2 weeks. And what's interesting is the yards per pass attempt is actually up 1.4 yards per play. So that's a positive. If you're looking at a declining interceptable pass rate while the increase of moving the ball downfield increases as well. So big there. We know Buffalo's defense is elite, right? That's not a question. So the growth has to come offensively, and so far it has.
Yeah, pretty incredible when you look at the report. He's starting to build with guys like Cole Beasley and John Brown. There was an extended stretch from probably early in the third quarter through maybe the start of the fourth where he looked to be out of sync. But clearly this guy has all of the skill sets that you're looking for, a big, strong athlete. And once he learns to develop a little bit of touch on his fastball, watch out for everybody else there. Devin Singletary, of course, also showing flashes. And more importantly for the Bills, the ageless wonder Frank Gore still ticking away, finding a way into
Singletary's dealing with a little bit of an injury too, I think, now.
And I was going to say, the workload, it seemed to be a little odd, the workload that they gave Frank Gore. I didn't realize he didn't score a rushing touchdown at all last season, so it was good to see him get into the end zone. When we look at some of the other positives, Payne, at least through 2 weeks, I mean, there's a couple of different ways we can go. We can praise Dak Prescott for continued prowess in the pocket and what he looked like putting up numbers. I know it's a Redskins defense, much maligned. But were there any other individual performances or teams that really turned your head?
I think you have to talk about the Cowboys, right? And specifically Dak, because our loyal listeners, if they've been listening since the NFC preview podcast, this isn't a surprise, right? There's a lot of guys looking at the Cowboys and looking at what they did last year and talking about all these close victories and how that's going to regress, but they didn't actually look at what the Cowboys had coming into this season. And Kellen Moore is now running things, and that's big for a lot of things, right? Like, Dak loves Kellen Moore as a guy who helped him when he jumped into the league, because Kellen Moore was the backup quarterback. So really helped Dak his rookie season get acclimated to the league. He trusts him. The playbook is fantastic, right? Everything's a little bit quicker, a little more passing. Then you get all these guys back, right? Travis Frederick back. We talked about him being one of the most important linemen in all of the league. Gallup and Barwin are taking huge leaps. You look at Dak's performance this week, though. Final three quarters, because they did come out a little bit slow, but those last three quarters, absolutely electric. 7.8 yards per play, 66% success rate, 8 explosive plays. I think Dak had his longest run in his career as well to boot. So this is a Cowboys team that is going to be vying, I think, for the NFC Championship and potential Super Bowl.
Yeah, Dak Prescott so far this season has completed more than 82% of his passes with 7 touchdown passes to boot. So clearly off on the right foot in that particular regard. Lions-Chargers game, Payne. I know we saw some professional money on the Lions. That number get bet all the way down from +3 to pick 'em. Was that the Lions being good against the Chargers, or is that just more, hey, look, this Chargers team right now is an absolute mash unit?
There was. At 3, a lot of professional money on the Lions came in, closed around 1. It was one of the larger teaser legs of the week as well. Obviously, the Chargers turned the ball over. There was a couple penalties. I know the one drive they scored touchdowns twice. They both got called back. It allowed Detroit to kind of live to fight another day. And then Matthew Stafford just delivers an absolute dime on a game winner. And then, oddly, like Phillip Rivers, you had all the time in the world. You could have went in, tied the game, or at least continued driving. And he threw one of those balls that just leaves you scratching your head. Throws up a 50-50 ball to Allen there. It gets picked off by my guy Darius Slay. So, very odd game altogether, but the Lions were the professional side there, both straight early in the week and one of the largest teaser legs as well.
Well, if you're going to take a shot at Phillip Rivers, and my positive state of mind lasted about 8 minutes on this podcast to kick things off for week 2 Monday Night Football, I want to go the negative direction. Can you explain to me who Kirk Cousins...
Shocking.
Can you explain
Shocking.
To me who... I mean, you knew we were going to get there. I was going to try and feign some positivity out of the gates, but eventually you finally show, like a tiger shows its stripes. Who's Kirk Cousins throwing to in a 21-16 game and a first and goal against the Packers?
First down, too. That's the worst thing about it. He was horrific. And honestly, if you're a Green Bay fan, I think you have to be very fortunate, because after that first quarter, it was ugly. And it looked like all signs were pointing to the Vikings coming out with a victory in this game once the defense started to figure some things out. But Kirk Cousins, I mean, you pay this guy all his money, and on first down, he's just lobbing it wasn't even a 50-50 ball. The defender, I believe King, had inside position on Diggs. So made absolutely no sense. That's one you park out of bounds. It's really been troubling with Kirk Cousins when he is under pressure, the decisions he makes with the football. It's really ugly. I know his final year in Washington led the league in interceptions when under pressure. So if you can get pressure on Kirk, he tends to panic and just throws the ball all over the place. Massive mistake there, because I thought they were going to end up winning that game.
Yeah, I mean, you spot the Green Bay Packers, a 21-0 lead at Lambeau. It looked like Minnesota didn't get off the bus, and all of a sudden everything is going your way. You're able to run the football. Dalvin Cook, another massive performance, and you even get Alexander Mattison involved, and just not enough for them to get over the hump.
Outgained the Packers by 2.1 yards per play, too. So it was just that ground game you alluded to was really what kept them in. Kirk Cousins was just, ugh. Horrendous. If he even has like an average performance, the Vikings win that game outright.
Oh, this is a game that, you know, Minnesota finds themselves a game or two back in the standings late in the year. I mean, they're going to come back and rue the day that they let this one kind of slip through their fingers, especially knowing that Aaron Rodgers and Matt LaFleur didn't appear to be on the same page for the better part of three quarters with a Packers offense that largely bogged down. Real quick, Payne, a couple other games, and I know we're not going to get to all of them. I wasn't sure if you had any thoughts on the Seahawks-Steelers. Seattle, of course, going on the road, taking care of Pittsburgh. Mason Rudolph fills in for Big Ben. I know we'll talk to Dr. Chow later in the show to see when Big Ben may or may not be back under center. Or, of course, the debacle in Denver with the Broncos dropping a game by 2 points to the Bears. It looked like they had scratched out a victory from the depths of despair.
I thought Mason Rudolph looked good. It, from what I saw and just looking at the numbers this morning, you know, in the first half with primarily Big Ben, I know he departed at about the 2 or 3 minute mark of the second quarter, or with two or three minutes remaining in the second quarter, rather. But you look at the first half, Steelers 4.3 yards per play, 42% success rate with Big Ben. In the second half, 5.9 yards per play, 52% success rate with Mason Rudolph. He looked pretty capable. There's a reason they moved Dobbs. So I think, you know, things looked a little better for the Steelers offensively. The problem is Mike Tomlin's defense fell apart in the second half. Gave up 8.8 yards per play in the second half. Once Big Ben goes out, right, it's on you, Mike Tomlin. It's on your defense to step up and shoulder that increased load. Instead, they regressed, right? And the 8.8 yards per play surrendered in the second half doesn't include the monstrous pass interference call there on Edmonds for an additional 38 yards. So Steelers, this is kind of the fear we had. We kind of just assumed that said, hey, Le'Veon Bell didn't play all of last year. No biggie. They seem to make up for that. But all the losses on offense, Mike Munchak, the offensive line coach. Now you're dealing with James Conner as well, left with a knee injury. We'll talk to Dr. Chow about that one, see what he says. Now you're on the road traveling across the country to face San Francisco. It's going to be interesting to see. It sounds like it'll be Mason Rudolph under center.
Yeah, very very interesting to see how some of these things kind of play themselves out, and you always wonder how these teams will rebound with some key faces that may or may not be there, and of course the Steelers staring down the barrel of that 0-2 start. We'll see if they can get things corrected, as you alluded to, their trip on the road to San Francisco. But as is the right of odds makers and bettors alike, you typically see overreactions in week two. By the time you get to week three, you're starting to get a better sense of who some of these teams are and identify how these numbers need to be set, figuring out from some of those situational edges. So when we look at the look-ahead lines for next week, Payne, not a ton of overreaction in the market by any stretch. You do have the Packers on a look-ahead number go from a 6.5-point favorite now to more than a touchdown chalk against the Denver Broncos, who have to wipe themselves up off the deck knowing they let a glorious opportunity against the Chicago Bears get away from.
It's spot on. Denver had their hearts ripped out. They're obviously not going to have the early season altitude advantage here like they had a week ago. You know, there's whispers within the locker room. Not all the players love Vic Fangio's old school coaching style. If you start 2-0 or you win a game like that and you're 1-1, suddenly players let that slide by. But when you're 0-2, now you're an 8-point underdog on the road. Let's see if they can overcome that. Once LaFleur's script wore off, though, for Green Bay, and the Vikings woke up, the Packers offense was back to sucking again. And you look in totality, it's just on the day, 4.9 yards per play for the Green Bay offense. The final three quarters, the Packers offense averaged 3.2 yards per play, a 40% success rate, and Rodgers had zero explosive passes the final three quarters. So still some things to figure out offensively there for Green Bay. Came out with their hair on fire, much to our chagrin. But that was kind of, after the first quarter, the pace and the output we kind of handicapped and projected there for the Green Bay offense.
Yeah, and they even were gifted a touchdown for the Minnesota Vikings when they turned the ball over to take that 14-0 lead out to 21. But we're not going to cry over spilled milk. We'll continue to look at some of the numbers for next week. And two massive point spreads that will remind you a lot more of college football than they will the National Football League. I couldn't even tell you in an historical context when you're going to see two favorites of this big a magnitude pain. Look ahead number for the Patriots, 13 points. Now, I know Sam Darnold, of course, was factored into this look ahead number. With him being out, regardless of how the Jets perform tonight against the Cleveland Browns, you're looking at the Pats, a 17.5-point favorite.
Yeah, some differing numbers on the look ahead. One shop had the look ahead as low as 10. They actually produced that before the Sam Darnold news, obviously. So, you know, you have the Patriots. They've outscored their opponents now 76-3. You know, Antonio Brown is a go and looks like a real factor. And it's not just Sam Darnold that's going to be down again, right? There's other guys that have some injury question marks for the Jets. Be interesting to see where this number goes, right? I think there's going to be a lot of movement. Obviously, it's not open everywhere right now. But, you know, if Trevor Siemian and the Jets pull off an upset tonight, or if they get blown out, this number is going to head in different directions, right? I think if the Jets get blown out, you're probably looking at closer to 20. If they somehow pull off this upset victory, you're probably trending back down towards two touchdowns.
Well, when you mentioned blowout, I guess no discussion of any NFL week is complete without mentioning your Miami Dolphins, who got drummed by the New England Patriots to the tune of 43-0 this past Sunday. You look at their number here, look ahead number for their trip to Big D to take on the Cowboys. Dallas, a 15.5-point favorite. Current number now out to a full three touchdowns.
The strategy this season for being a Miami Dolphins fan is I'll give them the big television, I guess, initially, just to watch like that opening drive or two when it's, you know, close. And then you just completely forget about them at that point. So ugly. Let's just put it that way. 384 yards total in two games, 4.3 yards against Baltimore with a 36% success rate. You follow that performance up with 3 yards per play against New England and a 28% success rate. The New England defense outscores your offense 14-0. I mean, Dolphins players are asking for trades again. Add Kenyon Drake to the fold, went to the agent, asked for a trade yesterday morning before the game. We already know Minkah Fitzpatrick wants out. It's not a pretty scene right now, man.
Question. And I mean, we always talk about, hey, look, you don't bet teams in this business, you bet numbers, and everyone ultimately has their price. How far do some of these prices have to go before professional bettors begin to become intrigued with Miami as 3 touchdown dogs?
Well, we saw that a little bit last week, right? It got to like 19.5, didn't really touch 20, but we closed at 18. And I think the thought process there was, hey, you know, if the Patriots are smart, and they are, this is going to be an extremely vanilla game plan. There's no reason to put anything on tape. And through the first half, you saw that Patriots often struggle a little bit with that vanilla game plan. And even through, you know, late in the third quarter, this is a game that I was kind of telling you, I'm like, hey, we need to be looking under here. I just can't see a scenario where New England runs this thing up, but then you get the two defensive scores and it bloats out to, you know, 43-0. But really vanilla game plan. The question becomes, and I think we'll obviously have a better indicator, you know, in week 5, 6, or 7, this could be a historically bad NFL team. This, obviously at this stage, you don't want to call it tanking. And I think that's what the outside world is saying. These guys are still playing hard. There's just not a lot of talent here at this point, right? They've kind of gotten rid of that. Now, we talked a little bit off air, the mindset, right? These players are now asking for trades. It wasn't going to be a good team to begin with, but I think, you know, when you're aligned 5 wins and you do have some young talent within the locker room, you're saying to yourself, okay, let's prove the world wrong. Let's go win 7 or 8 games. Let's try to sneak into the playoffs. Once you start removing these guys from the fold, internally, they're like, yeah, we're absolutely tanking at this point. If the organization doesn't care, why do I? Now, from my perspective is, you know, you're looking for your next big contract, so you shouldn't be putting shit on tape, right? You should be putting together, yeah, like an elite effort. And I think it probably goes a long way that you're still hustling your ass off in a 43-0 game. That's only beneficial to you and in your next contract. So guys aren't necessarily quitting here. But there's no talent at this point on the roster.
Yeah, tough to win in this league when you don't have playmakers out there, whether it's on the offensive or defensive side of the ball. I read an interesting article from one of the beat writers down there talking about, was it time to go to Josh Rosen? And didn't mean to be critical.
Good luck doing that.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest.
Not a lot of great beat writers down here.
Let's be honest. You can go to Josh Rosen. You might be able to bring back Dan Marino, and it's still not going to help out with the supporting cast. So not as though you're going to get a good indication of what this kid has talent-wise or anything else, as this is a full reclamation project that's going to be taking place in South Florida. If we head north, though, up to the west coast of Florida and look at Tampa, a pretty impressive outright victory in a short week against Carolina, holding on by the slimmest of margins, 1 yard, as Christian McCaffrey came up just short. You've seen their number balloon against the New York Giants. Look ahead, Price had the Bucs about a 3.5-point favorite, almost out to a full touchdown. Payne, I think this obviously has as much to do with the Bucs looking competent, especially on the defensive side in back-to-back weeks, and the Giants clearly having all sorts of issues, whether it's offensive, whether it's defensive, whether it's head coaching. Take your pick with what's wrong with Big Blue.
You know, big upset win for Tampa on national TV, and then obviously it's Thursday night, so you have a few extra days of rest. A lot of perception in the line. Obviously, Tampa's coaching staff is wildly improved. Todd Bowles, Casey Rogers have turned the league's worst defense. They were 32nd defensive efficiency last season, and through two games, they've held San Francisco to 4.3 a play, and they just hung 40-plus on the road. And then Carolina, you held to 4.8. So there's a lot of improvement there. Interestingly enough, though, for the Giants, and partly because they've trailed that this metric has unfolded, but the Giants are actually a net positive 2% in offensive success rate over their opponents in the first two games. So 0-2, but the success rate metrics look pretty good. But again, you got behind in these games. Defenses probably go a little bit softer. But interesting to see. 7's a big number.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. We'll see how the Bucs can handle Prosperity, a team not exactly built to go out there and cover big numbers right now. But a little more optimism on the west coast of Florida as Tampa sits at 1-1, knowing that they had a massive victory against the Carolina Panthers. But Payne, I mean, no discussion of what we saw on the football is complete with what we'll see going forward or some of the familiar faces we might not actually see out there.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, there's only one man to turn to.
If you're hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with 17-year NFL team doctor turned medical analyst, Dr. David Chow.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
This is Chow's Corner.
He joins us Monday mornings to break down some of the carnage that we see in the NFL over every single weekend. You can follow Dr. David Chow on Twitter at ProFootballDoc. There's no one with more extensive knowledge of the space. And Dr. Chow, it felt like yesterday was Armageddon, especially as it pertained to starting quarterbacks.
Well, at least two starting quarterbacks, right? And two stalwarts, two main ones, two top ones that's on everybody's mind.
And when we look at, I guess we'll start with Drew Brees. Ian Rapoport, of course, coming out this morning sharing that Brees will miss 6 weeks with a torn thumb ligament. We saw yesterday during the course of the game, he tried to go over, couldn't grip the football. They looked to retape his hand. So we knew the prognosis wasn't going to be good. As it pertains to the torn thumb ligament, should Saints fans or fantasy owners be optimistic that this could be a shorter timeline, or should they be taking a little more pessimistic approach that, hey, 6 weeks is probably a generous assumption of when he'll be back under center?
6 weeks is kind of the over-under. That's sort of a good target. You know, is he going to play that week 8 game, or is it going to be week 9 before he plays? I don't know. Depends on how he feels with the grip, and there is a way to brace it as well. And believe it or not, surgery is the quicker way to get him back. And that's why surgery is actually not bad news with what's going on here. So it's realistic. Many other quarterbacks have had this injury before and done fine when they come back. So once he's back, he should be fine. Andy Dalton ended his season last year with this exact injury, and his season was over only because of timeline. It was a later season injury.
In the other signal caller we kind of referenced at the top, Big Ben, it was a non-contact elbow injury. Is this something similar to what we saw last year with Bills quarterback Josh Allen and the UCL injury? And if so, what's the timeline here? What's the prognosis? Can he play through it? Give us everything on Big Ben that you have, Dr. Chow.
Well, you know, of course, I haven't examined him, so I don't know anything from the inside. You're putting together puzzle pieces off of video and reports from the outside. But given that, In some ways, it's very similar to Josh Allen, and there are some key ways it's very different. Similar because I believe it is also an ulnar collateral ligament or Tommy John ligament issue at the elbow, with perhaps some nerve irritation as well. Different because Josh Allen seemed to be more acute, whereas Big Ben appeared to be more chronic. There were reports that he was dealing with this issue all week in practice, or some sort of elbow inflammation all week. Josh Allen was hit on a play. He missed 4 weeks last year. What they do have in common is it's in theory the same ligament, and that they're both quarterbacks, not pitchers. This is a much bigger deal for pitchers with Tommy John surgery than for quarterbacks. And the reason why are the throwing mechanics are different for quarterbacks and pitchers, and the torque on the elbow. The last known case of Tommy John surgery in a quarterback was Jake Delhomme in 2007. Look, since 2017, there have been 20 cases of major known pitchers in baseball having this surgery. So you see the difference. Big Ben has an ulnar collateral ligament injury by all analysis, but that does not necessarily mean Tommy John surgery. But it will mean weeks missed.
And in your estimation, how many weeks do you think that would be? I've heard, you know, surgery, or I've heard letting it scar. Is this something we see Big Ben back in a month or two, or is he potentially lost for the season like an MLB pitcher would be?
Well, I said all along, and yesterday at the ProFootballDoc.com site and on video yesterday and this morning, that Drew Brees' recovery is more finite, smaller window. Best case, a few weeks. Worst case, 6-8 weeks at most. It's kind of a 4-8 week window type situation with or without surgery. Big Ben's is much more variable. Without surgery, he's going to miss a couple of weeks at least. Could be a month. With surgery, he's definitely missing the rest of the season. And it might even impact into next season, depending on how he recovers. So there's way more variability on Big Ben than there is on Drew Brees in terms of what's going to happen. My guess and hope is they're going to give it a month and see if he can return without surgery.
Wow. And his running mate, when it rains, it pours in Pittsburgh this weekend. James Conner also left with a knee injury. We know back in 2015 with the Pitt Panthers, Conner had a torn MCL. Then in his rookie year, had another knee injury, which required surgery in 2017. What do we make of Conner's knee injury against Seattle in terms of its severity and timeline of return?
So far, I've only saw one video replay and waiting for some of the other Game Pass stuff and to try and look at it again. But I don't see a major knee ligament issue here. I'm hoping more of a bone contusion type issue that's not long term than any ligament issues. But we'll try and add more information as we learn it here.
Hopefully some positive news there with James Conner as it pertains to him and Steelers fans. Last one I want to ask you about, Dr. Chow, before I toss the baton back to Todd. Left tackle Joe Staley got injured late in the third quarter on a pitch outside. Kyle Shanahan said after the game that Staley suffered a broken fibula, but the injury might not be season ending. With the 49ers 2-0, playoffs on their mind, is it possible that Captain Joe Staley returns for the playoff push, Doctor?
Hopeful and expecting him to return well before the playoffs. And as you put it, for the playoff push, I think there's a reasonable chance, if things break their way, so to speak, that he returns in November. If it goes their way, and it might be late November, but yes, I do think there is a reasonable chance that Joe Staley's season is not done. And as you know, the new IR rules, you don't even have to designate him to return right now. You can see how he's doing and you get two players to come off later. And Joe Staley is likely one of the leading candidates.
It's always interesting to see how key cogs can go down early in the season. I think a lot of people obviously have major impacts for some of the injuries from the quarterback positions, running back. Dr. Chow, before the football season started, I never thought we'd have to ask you this particular question, but hey, things beyond our scope of comprehension often come up. Sam Darnold dealing with mono, not exactly a injury or a virus synonymous with football players. How long do we think the Jets will be without their franchise quarterback?
Yeah, when news broke on this on Thursday, I jumped on it early that the issue isn't that he's going to miss Monday Night Football. The issue was that he's going to miss September, period. Now, good news would be to return sometime in October, and it could be as long as November, depending on his symptoms. A couple reasons for that. The medical reason is even if he feels better this next week from the weight loss and the acute symptoms of mono, he still has an enlarged spleen and or liver likely for a couple of weeks, and that's an increased risk of internal organ damage with contact and contact of football. That's why I do not believe he will play in September, period. Has a chance for October. But here's the thing, when I said right off the bat, I don't know, Payne or Todd, if you guys in school, college or high school had mono or had friends had mono, but a general question, if you or your buddy had mono, how many weeks did he or she miss class typically?
I mean, you weren't really out that long a period of time. I don't want to speak for Payne. It was a couple of days, but the biggest fear with mono, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Chow, is that they were always worried about being contagious and trying to infect your other classmates. So they wanted to kind of quarantine you whenever possible.
There's no question there's the infection portion, which is one of the other reasons that he was going to be out for a little bit. You can't have it spreading across the locker room through close contact. And I'm not talking kissing, obviously, but water bottles and standard precautions, et cetera. But the typical for a kid when they get mono to miss class is easily 2 to 4 weeks and sometimes longer. And that's just to go to class, not to play NFL football. That's where our timeline is. And I think Ian Rappaport has since sort of confirmed it, saying the Jets are expecting 3 to 7 weeks. And that fits with kind of what I've been saying.
Hey, I have to say that there's probably Jets fans out there that are optimistic that you called them an NFL football team, so that's what they put on display last week. But clearly something impactful for a team dealing with a number of injuries in a game that we're going to get to later in the show. Hey, this is why we have you on, Dr. Chow, to kind of contextualize and put in perspective exactly how long some of our loyal listeners' favorite teams will be without their best players. People can follow you on Twitter at ProFootballDoc, one of the best in the business as it pertains to real-time injury information as you watch the games unfold. Thank you, Dr. Chow, and we'll look forward to doing this again with you same time next week.
Thanks, guys.
Always interesting, Payne, getting Dr. Chow's take. I didn't think we were going to have to talk about not one, not two, but three starting quarterbacks who are poised to miss some extended time, and Big Ben, Drew Brees, and of course Sam Darnold dealing with mono. It looks like the Jets have ruled him out, not only for the game tonight, which we'll get to in just a few seconds, but also the game next week against New England and speculation about week 5 return.
I didn't even know if we had to ask Dr. Chow about Sam Darnold and his mono. You were a wildcat back in college, so I figured you would probably have a little better assessment on what the mono outlook looks like, what you have to do to get rid of it, how long you're down, all those kind of things.
I kept myself clean, Payne. I don't need you here casting aspersions or passing judgments at my sordid behavior back in the day when I was a younger man.
Ah, gotcha.
So we do, we can.
Did you notice, we watched the Saints game, and I, of course, had a little joke when Andres Pete went down again and his replacement came in. His name was Clapp. So
I was waiting for it. I mean, you can go with the Jimmy Dugan line if you want.
Yeah, there you go.
But all right, we got one game left to get to. Of course, it's the Browns and Jets tonight. Both these teams come in with disappointing opening week performances. The Jets melted down, blowing a 16-0 lead against the Buffalo Bills. Thankful for all of our Bet the Board listeners that unfolded the way it did. Cleveland, of course, looked like they were still stuck in the preseason, getting absolutely housed by the Tennessee Titans as a 5.5-point favorite. When you look at the number here, Cleveland, a 6.5-point road favorite, total in the game 45. This number up, of course, from 2.5, where Cleveland would have been listed as the favorite before Sam Darnold was ruled out. But it's not just Sam Darnold, Payne. The Jets dealing with a number of injuries both on the offensive and defensive side of the ball.
Yeah, and let's kind of start there. I think it's the obvious, you know, Sam Darnold's out. Mono. Some books open Cleveland -1 juiced. Others -2.5. We're now sitting at 6.5 with a few sevens out there. In my mind, it's tough to envision Sam Darnold being worth this much to the spread. And, you know, numerically, the markets are saying right now Sam Darnold's worth 4 to 5 points. But value-wise, we know it's more, right? You're going through the 3, the 4, the 6, and in some places you're now touching the 7. And Darnold is absolutely not worth what the market's currently indicating. Obviously, there's a little CJ Mosley, there's a little Quinn and Williams kind of being mixed into that equation as well. But still, this is interesting here. And I kind of alluded to this on Thursday's show when I didn't even know it happened and you kind of broke that news. And I said, it'll be interesting to see where this gets. And regardless of result, I would envision at 7, we are going to see professional money on the Jets. And we've kind of seen this before, right? Adam Gase has been in this position. You look last year, Ryan Tannehill went down in the Cincinnati game. And the very next week, you know, the 12-win Chicago Bears come to town. The spread closes Bears minus 7.5 on the road, and Adam Gase wins the damn thing outright with Brock Osweiler. So the difference, obviously, in that comparison is Gase doesn't have the advantage of the Miami weather to help him out and kind of wear down his opponent. But I think, you know, the reference point kind of applies here. You have that initial game one overreaction to an average to below average quarterback currently, right? I think Sam Darnold has potential, but currently, I think, you know, at the very best, he's an average quarterback, probably a little bit below. So the market inflates. And then you have this one game sample where everyone's probably going to step up a little bit. I mean, Brock Osweiler did last year, averaged 7.2 yards per pass. The Dolphins had a 52% success rate in that game. So it'll be interesting to see what we get from Trevor Siemian. I think the goal is you got to keep him upright, right? I think that's probably the biggest thing here. I don't know where we want to go from here. We can probably jump into the Jets offense. That seems like a likely transition point.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect spot to go. Quincy Enunwa lost for the season. We know Le'Veon Bell had an MRI. They said more precautionary than anything else. By all accounts, he should be out there at a full go. But you look at the Jets receiving core, Demaryius Thomas, of course, acquired from the New England Patriots, still dealing with a hamstring injury. So it probably means more Josh Bellamy, Ty Montgomery, other players that have to step up and give Siemian a chance. But the biggest question I have, Payne, is the Jets offensive line didn't exactly acquit themselves all too well in the season opener. Can they do enough to slow down the Browns' pass rush, as we know the defensive line for Cleveland, one of this team's strengths?
Yeah, that's the big thing. And you look, and Buffalo got pressure on Darnold last week, 39% of his dropbacks. And, you know, when you look at this, we always knew that Greg Williams loves to blitz, but now Steve Wilks, the new Browns defensive coordinator, actually likes the blitz more. And so that's going to be the big thing here. Wilks has blitzed over 51% of his time and nearly 46% of the time the last two seasons on the defenses he's controlled. And the Browns got after Mariota. I know they lost the opener to Tennessee, but Mariota was pressured on 43% of his dropbacks. So this is a game, I think, where, you know, the Jets are going to have to rely on the $52 million running back. I think the extra day probably should help Bell's shoulder recover a little bit. I know it's tough, right? All these guys do this work in the offseason. They're trying to get in shape, but football shape is a little bit different, right? It means, you know, having your body get acclimated to hard hits again. And so that game against Buffalo was Le'Veon Bell's first in over 600 days. They need him to be the horse here, right? You mentioned Enunwa. He's out. That's a massive blow. It's a huge weapon to be missing from the Jets offense. I think the ball has to come out a little bit quicker for Siemian. Use Jamison Crowder. Get Bell going out of the backfield. I think you also have to shrink this game down, right? Slow things down, create more variance. We know Adam Gase loves to do that. He knows how to do it. Last year, the Dolphins offense was 31st in pace. Gase always claimed that injuries were the reason his offenses weren't going faster. He tried implementing some pace in the preseason, claimed there was going to be more pace this year with Sam Darnold. There was a lack of talent was why he was going so slow in Miami. I don't know if that's actually the case, but I think tonight's interesting with Siemian and a banged up defense that you're probably going to want to operate a little bit more slowly here. It'll be vital to win first down and to extend the chains on third, so your defense, it's a little bit banged up, isn't on the field so much.
Will the Jets be able to run the ball effectively enough, in your opinion? We look at Cleveland, and while they brought pressure on Mariota, they still gave up 120-plus yards on the ground to this Tennessee Titans rushing attack.
That's obviously the goal, right? When you want to slow this game down, it helps picking up 3 or 4, even 5 yards on first down, keep the clocks rolling, and then it's up to Trevor Siemian, or, you know, to extend the drives on third down or have short yardage situations on third. So it's extremely vital that the ground game gets going, whether it's Lev Bell or anyone else. Montgomery is, I was shocked at Montgomery's workload in the first game. I thought based on his skill set and attributes that Montgomery would probably have a little bit larger workload. Maybe we see that if that's the case this game, because Bell is a little bit dinged up, but I was shocked Montgomery didn't get more burn in the opener.
Makes two of us. You figure Gase has always been a coach to use a running back by committee approach and get guys a decreased workload early on, maybe go with the hot hand. So it'll be definitely interesting to monitor Montgomery's usage on that side of the ball. When we look at the other side, Cleveland's offense, we talked about it. Baker Mayfield didn't exactly show discretion with some of the throws he made, whether he was nicked up or call it what you will. But Cleveland's offense, this high-flying unit with so much star power, didn't achieve the lofty heights, at least in week one. This week, a little bit more favorable matchup when you look at this Jets secondary led by Tremaine Johnson and Darrell Roberts. Probably not the ideal cornerback tandem you want matched up against Odell Beckham Jr. and Jarvis Landry.
Rough contract there for Tremaine Johnson. Oof. You know, you mentioned Baker dealing a little bit with the dinged up bruised throwing wrist. Regardless, I think when you look at this game, it starts up front for Cleveland. You know, we know what Baker can do. We know this treasure chest of shiny toys he has. The question mark before the season was the offensive line. And if you look kind of, you know, just skimming the surface against Tennessee, the offensive line appeared to do okay, right? You only see 13 pressures given up. But the majority of the 182 penalty yards, Todd, they were either holding penalties because an O-lineman was beat, or it was a false start because an O-lineman was trying not to get beat.
Well, you mean taking two football fields worth of penalties isn't something you strongly encourage as a blueprint for winning football games at this level, Payne?
It's not good, right? It just put that Browns offense behind the down and distance. Cleveland also didn't win on first down in that game. Averaged 4.9 yards per play against Tennessee on first down. So, you know, when you look at perspective there, Jacksonville was the NFL's worst offense on first down last season. They averaged 4.8 yards per play. So you kind of made mention of this. It's tough to win football games when you're not winning on first down. You know, you're accumulating two football fields worth of penalty yards. It makes things pretty predictable, right, for a defense. So, you know, it's tough to add that play action element, right, when you're in second and a mile and third and forever. And so when you look at that, you know, play action passes, Baker's number of play action passers decreased in game one compared to his average all of last season. And Baker's much better with the play action element. 13 points higher for his passer rating last year. In game one, his completion percentage was 21% higher with a play fake element implemented. And so it's tough to do those kind of things when you're backed up. Some injuries on this side of the ball as well in the trenches. And so I think we want to monitor the starting left guard, Joel Bentonio, for this game. Recording this at 7 a.m. Vegas time. So monitor that situation. Everyone I'm kind of talking to says that Bentonio is a gamer. We'll see. We know Greg Robinson at left tackle is an absolute liability. So if Bentonio is out at left guard, all of a sudden Baker's blindside could be compromised a little bit. Fortunately for Cleveland, and we talked about this at the top, C.J. Mosley, Jets top linebacker, is out. That injury, I think, becomes even larger, right? When you lose your second best guy in the preseason, Avery Williamson, to the torn ACL. We told you on Thursday, Quinnen Williams was going to be out in this game. I think he was finally announced out on Saturday. The other one to watch here is Steve McClendon along the Jets defensive line. He's questionable if he can't go. Now, suddenly, you know, the Jets are down two of their five linemen that played the most week one snaps against Buffalo. The other thing that's when you try to project C.J. Mosley, and this is obviously an exaggerated example because it's a one quarter sample, but either way, C.J. Mosley being out is massive. And with Mosley in the game against Buffalo the first three quarters, Josh Allen and the Bills offense averaged 4.4 yards per play and a 45% success rate. C.J. Mosley leaves late third quarter. The Jets' next possession, the Bills' next possession, And throughout the fourth quarter, all of a sudden Buffalo averaged 9.2 yards per play and a 68% success rate on offense when C.J. Mosley was out. So I think that's That's a big thing. That's a big guy to be losing there on defense.
Calls all the plays, gets everybody lined up where they need to be. And clearly that was not the case, as you mentioned, against Buffalo, as the Bills put together marches twice of 80-plus yards to get you to the window at 17-16. When we talk about the number on this game, Payne, I know we touched on it at the top of breaking this thing down. Out to 6.5, we most likely, well, I don't want to say most likely, but I think we'll see some 7 and obviously some resistance from professionals. What do we think as far as the total is concerned, given the myriad of injuries we just listed off here?
So it looks like one of the shops, as we're talking, actually just came off the 7, and the sharpest shop in the world is using 6 now. So we're already starting to see a little bit of that Jets professional money. Regardless of result, that is the accurate information on where the pros are at in this game. Now, we initially saw this total open 46. There was some under money that came in. And then once all the defensive injuries came out, there was a group that went over 44. So I don't know where we're going. I think if books are trying to attract some more pro money, you're going to get this back to 7. The total, I think we're in a decent area right now, especially if what I think is going to unfold does, where the Jets attempt to shorten this game. Obviously, Cleveland's offense is going to try to score as many as they can at this point, especially with how this week's developed with the whole back and forth between OBJ and Greg Williams. And Greg Williams, you know, talking privately about feeling slighted for this job, and obviously Freddie Kitchens knows that. So Cleveland, if they can, is going to try to hang a big number here. That's one thing that is interesting in this game. I know a lot of people talk about it. We haven't yet, but the familiarity with Greg Williams in this matchup. One thing to note a little bit is Greg Williams actually is going to switch. He chose to switch his Jets defense to a 3-4 this season. What he ran in Cleveland last year was a 4-3. So it's going to look a little bit different. I'm intrigued to see defensively for the Jets what lineup they go with, right? Because it's tough to go with a 3-4 if your linebacker core is absolutely decimated. So I'm interested to see what that looks like. Njoku could have a decent game here, right? If Greg Williams decides to have his ego get involved, he's probably going to send some heat. We know he loves to do that. And last year with the Browns defense, Greg Williams gave up 100 receptions to tight ends. That was second most in the NFL. So I don't know what Greg Williams is going to do, because I don't know if he can really play a ton of 3-4 here with all those linebacker injuries. And you would hope that his style would mesh a little bit with what Adam Gase is trying to do. So quick three and outs would be huge. So maybe you are going to see some pressure. If that's the case, a lot of quick passing potentially for Kitchens and Baker within this offense.
You talk about that level of familiarity, and we see it probably more, I don't want to say more so in college, but we saw a perfect illustration of that last Friday night in a game between Houston and Washington State. Coaches that knew each other all too well started slow and never even came close to sniffing kind of that shootout anticipated. You mentioned the Freddie Kitchens, Greg Williams, all that level of familiarity. How do you factor some of those elements into handicapping? Maybe not even just this game, but more to contextualize in general how that stuff should apply.
Very important, right? You know, when, with your example, I believe that game was on Friday night. You know, you're looking at a Houston defense and a Washington State defense that necessarily aren't great, but they're used to seeing that style of offense at practice every single day. So that's the one offense that they're really familiar with and already acclimated with. There was a ton of sharp money despite what that line went to. And despite it closed right around where it opened at 74.5, but under was the sharp side there. But the one thing that I kind of pointed out and mentioned here, even though there is this familiarity in this Monday Night Football game with Greg Williams and Freddie Kitchens, Greg Williams' defense looks a little bit different this year, moving to that 3-4. So it's not necessarily what Baker Mayfield saw in practice every day. I'm not sure what they're going to try to employ, though, tonight with those linebackers injured. But obviously, Greg Williams isn't playing with a full deck of cards here with the loss of Quinnen Williams, with the loss of C.J. Mosley, and then obviously Avery Williamson already being out. So he's a little shorthanded on that side of the ball. So I'm not really sure what the Jets are going to try to do defensively here. But you would think Try to force some turnovers, try to force some quick three and outs, get the ball back to your offense and let them control the clock a little bit.
An intriguing game, no doubt, especially with both these teams starting 0-1. Some of them had unrealistic expectations, I guess we can suffice to say, when it came to the Jets. A lot of people making a case for them to go over their win total at 7.5. Cleveland, of course, being the front runners in the AFC North, it appears to be a little bit more wide open now. With some of the Pittsburgh Steelers struggles, but this Browns schedule going forward does them no favors if they were to drop this particular game tonight with the Rams coming to town for Sunday Night Football next week. I think we've done enough damage for a Monday morning. Payne, what do you think?
Yeah, let's wrap it up and get this thing out there before lunchtime.
Special thanks to Dr. David Chow, as always, for some of that great injury information to put better perspective how long the respective teams will be with or without Ben Roethlisberger, Drew Brees, Sam Darnold, what have you. For Payne Insider, you can follow him on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. And of course, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. Best of luck with wherever your wagers take you this Monday Night Football game. We'll be back here with you on Wednesday to preview marquee matchups in college football. And of course, right back here on Thursday for the National Football League Week 3 schedule. And hopefully we'll see you at the window.